If you've lived long enough, then it shouldn't be hard to remember the times that you've tried to avoid suffering. Times that you would have been willing to trade anything just to avoid the pain. This is one of those moments for Peter. He rebukes Jesus as a last-ditch effort to avoid the pain.
That's the Reverend Betsy Sweetenberg. And today she shares a life-giving message of faith called, That's What He Said. Get behind me, Satan. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're honored to have with us the Reverend Betsy Lyle Sweetenberg, senior pastor of Northridge Presbyterian Church in Dallas, Texas. Betsy is a graduate of Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina. Before coming to Northridge, she was associate pastor for adult ministries at Trinity Presbyterian Church in Atlanta, and earlier served as Director of Admissions and Financial Aid at Columbia Theological Seminary in Decatur, Georgia, where she earned her Master of Divinity degree. Betsy, welcome to Day One.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's such a joy to be with you today.
You became senior pastor of Northridge Presbyterian Church in Dallas right in the middle of the pandemic. How did you and the church cope with that big change?
Oh, it was hard. I am still exhausted thinking about it because I think, like many people, when the pandemic happened, once I realized that things would be shut down as I made this transition, I was naive about how long it would last. Mm-hmm. And so mentally, I kept preparing myself for maybe a few months at the beginning of my tenure where I couldn't gather with people. And it just kept being extended and extended. But I will say that this congregation went so far above and beyond. Mm. They held a reverse parade when I arrived, and they had people come and park on the church property and be in their cars or just outside of their cars. And my husband and I drove a golf cart around the church property. So we went and said hello to everyone. And we found other ways to gather. We started some outdoor worship opportunities, and there were many outdoor dinners that were very distanced and with few people. So we tried to do what we could, but I still find that a year later, I'm learning what people look like without masks on. And so the people I did learn, I learned their eyes, but now I get the rest of the face.
So tell us more about the church you serve, its people, its mission, and outreach.
Yes. Northridge is a mid-sized church of about 550 members, and it's nestled in the community of Lakewood in East Dallas. It's a residential neighborhood, a lot of young families. This church moved to this location in the 1950s, and it was a combination of a couple of other congregations in East Dallas. And this church has always been a neighborhood church. It has always looked to serve the people who are in the surrounding area. And so I think that's a really important piece of this congregation's identity, that even as the neighborhood has changed, the congregation has found new ways to serve the neighbors. So one, I would say that this congregation is so welcoming. And really, because it's a neighborhood church, relationships are the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that stood out as I learned about this church community is that they seem to be a community that prioritizes relationships with each other over conflict when things get heated or when people disagree. And I think that is so beautiful that even when there's tension, people value doing whatever it takes to stay in relationship with one another. This church has just in the last, 5 years or so, started asking, what does our city need and how are we how can we serve? Mm-hmm. And so noticing just the influx of refugees in the city of Dallas, they created what is called Northridge Without Borders, working in conjunction with the IRC, welcoming refugees to the city of Dallas and being sure that they get the supplies that they need, that they're able to set up their life here. I guess this was really in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so right now we're seeing another influx of refugees to Dallas. And so that has really fortified this community about welcoming the strangers in our midst. And so it is a mission-oriented congregation and a relational congregation. But even through the pandemic, we've taken those values and we, like every other congregation, can't do all the things that we've been used to doing. And so we started asking about new ways to express our commitment for relationship. And one thing that we noticed was that parents need some reprieve. Parents had no idea what they were getting into in the last year in terms of maintaining work, usually at their dining room tables, and also trying to become homeschool teachers. Hmm. And it was a really intense pressure. And so a member of the congregation has experience running summer day camps. And so she took programming and gathered up teachers. And so right now we're in the midst of hosting day camps for, you know, hundreds of kids across the city of Dallas, which gives the parents some reprieve and allows the kids to be in a controlled environment, but also just giving parents the chance to reconnect with one another and not focus on providing childcare while also working and all of those things mm-hmm. that they've been doing for the last year.
So I understand, Betsy, you earned a scholarship in your senior year of college that paid for a trial year of seminary, and you enrolled at Columbia Theological Seminary to try it out. Obviously, it worked. What happened?
Yes, great question. Well, Davidson College has this very interesting scholarship that is called the Church and Vocation Scholarship, and it's based on those old Rockefeller scholarships mm-hmm. that used to provide funds for people to pursue a year of theological education. And my senior year, I was pretty sure that I would stay in the United States if I was going to grad school, or I would go abroad and work for a year or two. Mm-hmm. And I'd actually received an offer letter from a university in South Korea mm-hmm. about some research I'd done. And they were going to bring me on to the faculty to work with their teachers. I had done a lot of research on how faculty can better support ESL students mm-hmm. and support them so that they're ready for American education, because so many of them wind up in the States for higher education. And so I was feeling really great. And a mentor of mine, John Kirkendall, who was serving as the interim president at the time, he's also a Presbyterian pastor, took mm-hmm. me to coffee and said, "You know, Betsy, I think you have gifts and graces for ministry, and you really owe it to yourself and to the church to figure out whether it's a fit." And I just laughed, said, "No, thank you." And he said, "Betsy, if no is the answer, that's fine. We never need to talk about this again, but you need to think about this seriously. So take a month and pray about it." And at that time, I really couldn't think of anything that was more uncomfortable than going to seminary. I was pretty sure I'd be a committed lay leader. And so I ultimately decided, well, let's just see what happens if I'm uncomfortable and go try it out. So the scholarship provided a year of study at either Union Seminary or Columbia Seminary. Those are both Presbyterian schools. And Columbia was a good fit for me. And in that first year, I just remember being surrounded by faculty who amazed me. And I loved the chance to ask questions about faith. I grew up in a college town, so my Sunday school classes were always taught by college professors. So that whole idea about asking big questions about faith was really appealing to me, and that was what had been modeled for me my entire life. But to do it and get a degree at the end just felt like such a luxury. And at some point, I just decided that theological education was such a privilege. And having that privilege to be educated, I needed to share it. And so I wasn't quite sure what that was going to mean for me and for my vocation. I tested out a lot of different ways to use it. I worked for a nonprofit foundation. I worked for Columbia Seminary after I graduated, thinking maybe that would combine my love for higher education as well as the church. And ultimately, what I realized was that I love the chance to accompany people in their journey of faith while they're asking big questions and while they're seeking what it means to be faithful today. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself back in the church serving as an associate pastor and now, of course, at Northridge.
Hmm. Betsy, you've said that the church is the most sustainable form of transformation for our world, but sustainability is not the same as efficiency. So how do you see the church evolving in its work of transformation in the future?
It's a good question. I think, well, one, I will say generationally, I am a millennial. And so in college, when I told some of my friends that I was going to seminary, they just laughed and said, why? You have potential. And, you know, you could make something of yourself. Go be a lawyer. And I think that that sentiment is really pervasive right now, that people don't necessarily associate the church with change as they did at one time. And that stings to me as someone who loves the church. But I think as we've seen this rise of nonprofits, especially nonprofits that are very clear about which issue they're taking on, it does call into question how the church operates. And it's hard not to notice that the church tries to take on lots of issues because, of course, the gospel is not a single issue. There are so many things that are born out of our faith that need addressing. And so I think that for churches, getting to a place where it's okay to either collaborate with other churches. I went to a food pantry in Dallas when I moved here just to ask about how they're set up. And they said, oh, well, we have this church that's the peanut butter church, and we have this church that's the bread church, and this church is the grape jelly church. And I thought that was such an interesting model where in churches, instead of trying to do all things, they divided amongst themselves and said, we'll work together and we'll each take one thing. And I think churches may need to get to a place where that's more comfortable, where we can collaborate with one another to get to a larger picture that serves our communities. It's been such an instinct for churches to try to do everything. And I think denominations, too. I've often wondered what would happen for denominations if we said, okay, we're going to let this denomination be the denomination that's really great at education, and we'll support their seminaries, and we'll let another denomination be the liturgy denomination or whatever it may be. But maybe there's a form of sustainability in that when we are comfortable with our gifts and allow that comfort to help us collaborate with others. And I think that's happening some, but I think there's a lot of room to grow.
Well, Betsy, your sermon today draws from the gospel for this Sunday from Mark chapter 8. Would you read it for us?
Sure. The gospel is from Mark chapter 8, verses 27 through 38. Listen now to what the Spirit is saying to her church this day. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." Jesus asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And Jesus sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, Let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Betsy, we look forward to hearing your sermon on this, which you've titled, "That's What He Said, Get Behind Me, Satan." Thanks for sharing it with us.
You're welcome. What a joy it is to share with you.
This is Peter Wallace. Thank you for listening to Day One. But don't just listen. Why not join the Day One movement by supporting our ministry of proclaiming the good news of Jesus Christ on the radio, by podcast, and online? Your gift of any amount can make a big difference in so many lives. You can mail your contribution to Day One, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. That's 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. Or call us at 404-815-9110. Or donate securely online at dayone.org. Please give so that Day One can continue to share faith, hope, and love through powerful preaching. Thank you, and may God bless you.
When I was taking an Old Testament class in seminary, I remember studying the book of Exodus and becoming very bothered by that matter-of-fact detail in the text that the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. The God I knew was in the business of softening hearts, not hardening them. So one day after class, I approached my professor, Brennan Breed, and asked how we're to make sense of that detail, secretly hoping that he'd have a quick but satisfactory explanation, and I could shift my focus to other details in the text. Brennan looked at me and said, "Just do the same thing we do with other hard scriptures. Pretend like you didn't see it and keep going." He was joking, of course, but there was truth to his sentiment. Sometimes scriptures give us details about God that we'd prefer not to know. And when we learn something that doesn't fit with the picture we've already developed, it's easier to pretend like we never learned that detail than it is to frantically shift our image of God to include the newest information. Today's text is another one of those passages that makes me want to pretend like I didn't see it and just keep going. Get behind me, Satan? Really? Jesus is capable of saying that to one of his followers? And Peter at that, the one on whom Jesus will build his church. There's no way to take the bite off of those harsh words. They even taste putrid as they come out of my mouth. And the task of the preacher is to find the good news to share with you. But this four-word rebuke makes me want to shirk that responsibility altogether. Because when I'm honest about this text, I know that these are the very last words I'd ever want Jesus to say to me. These are the last words that I'd want someone other than Jesus to say to me, for that matter. Nor are they words I'd willingly say to somebody else. They sound like an uncharacteristic outburst. At least I secretly hope they're an uncharacteristic outburst. So it's easier for me to pretend like I didn't hear these words from Jesus and keep going. And maybe that instinct is why we're far more likely to quote what follows this rebuke, reciting Jesus' instruction for followers to take up their cross and follow. For some reason, it's a little bit softer on the ears than, "Get behind me, Satan." I think Peter shares this instinct with us. He wants to pretend he didn't hear it too. You see, Peter is feeling pretty confident in this text. When Jesus asks, "Who do you say that I am?" he aces the pop quiz. Peter is the one disciple who gets it right. "The Messiah," he quickly answers. Peter has a well-formed image of Jesus. He thinks he knows Jesus. He thinks he knows what it means to follow Jesus. He thinks he knows what it means for Jesus to be Jesus. So when Jesus opens his mouth and says that he needs to undergo suffering, face rejection, and die, Peter isn't prepared for that information. Jesus, my Messiah, will suffer? Jesus, my Messiah, will be killed? As his mind spins with questions, Peter has a choice. He can either rethink everything he thought he knew about Jesus and about what it means to follow Jesus, or he can put his head down, cover his ears, and pretend like he didn't hear this unsavory detail. Of course, Peter does what we'd all do. In a clear and compelling display of humanity, he pulls Jesus to the side and begins to rebuke him, thinking that a quick pep talk would help Jesus erase all the negativity and suffering from his vocabulary. Peter wanted to override Jesus's narrative, because at the end of the day, that seemed easier than adjusting his image of Jesus. Peter thought he'd picked a winner. Peter thought he'd picked a Messiah who didn't have to suffer. Because how can you have an almighty and all-powerful God if God has to suffer? How can God deliver us if God can't deliver God's self? Peter probably thought he was doing Jesus a favor, reminding him of that small but very significant detail that he is both human and God, reminding him that he could choose to avoid the suffering. And I imagine that just beneath Peter's reminder that Jesus could save himself from suffering was the human yearning we all have at some point, to know that Jesus will spare his followers of suffering too. If we're honest, don't we all want to duck and cover when suffering shows up, hoping that somehow we can avoid it or at least fortify ourselves so we're not affected by it? If you've lived long enough, then it shouldn't be hard to remember the times that you've tried to avoid suffering, times that you would have been willing to trade anything just to avoid the pain. Maybe you had one or several of those moments in the last 18 months during the pandemic where you felt like bargaining so that you could avoid the weight of suffering. This is one of those moments for Peter. He rebukes Jesus as a last-ditch effort to avoid the pain. And it's in this moment, where Peter is trying to avoid the pain, that Jesus snaps with those words, "Get behind me, Satan." These words are just as harsh as they sound. But what's nestled in them is Jesus telling Peter, "You're missing the point." Of course, Peter is tempted by a path that doesn't include suffering. That's human. But Jesus knows what Peter hadn't yet learned, that suffering cannot be avoided. Jesus had already been driven into the wilderness and tempted by the prospect of bypassing suffering. But he didn't. He stayed the course. He walked through it because facing our pain is part of the sacred journey of transformation. At 30 years old, David Bailey began to experience awful headaches. He tried to ignore them and refused to see a doctor, but eventually, a seizure led to the discovery of a baseball-sized brain tumor and a prediction that he wouldn't live more than 6 months. He had two young children and a wife he loved and a promising job in corporate America. Rightfully, David couldn't help but ask, "Why me?" each morning when he woke up, It was the first thought to cross his mind, and it stirred up fiery rage in his bones. He wanted God to answer for his suffering. Better yet, he wanted God to put an end to his suffering. Don't we all ask that question when we face suffering? Why me? I know that's true in my life. When I think about the times I've faced suffering, I've wanted nothing more than a button that would allow me to bypass the pain altogether. And if I can't bypass it, then I want to understand it, because if I can understand the pain, then I can at least try to control it. And I have given myself so much practice trying to control pain. After a while, David said he realized that his anger toward God was pointless, and it wasn't helping him get an answer to his question, so he changed his question. He began each day asking, "What now? What now, God? What will you teach me through this pain?" Asking what now is what ultimately led David to leave his corporate job and pursue his passion for music full time. Through song, he shared what he was learning about himself, his faith, and God. He performed all over the country, which is how I encountered him and learned his story. He led a youth conference I attended in high school, and I was taken aback by how honestly he spoke of his pain. I was amazed that his suffering had drawn him into a deeper relationship with God and others, instead of making him want to throw up his arms and walk away from it all. David outlived that six-month prediction by 14 years, and I was just one of many people who came to learn something about pain from him. Through his own suffering, he came to know that pain is always our teacher. And he showed me and so many others that pain is always a chance to learn something new about ourselves and our faith if we're willing to embrace it. Friends, we need this text, even though our most natural instinct is to skip over it. We need to be reminded that Jesus suffered. I still have moments where I want to sanitize the gospel, preferring a faith void of any suffering. But a faith cleansed of suffering is superficial. We don't believe in a God who bypasses pain. We believe in a God who is so much bigger than that. We believe in a God who walks with us through the deepest darkness, so that the deepest darkness is the very place where grace is reborn, instead of where it goes to die. My friends, I don't know where you are today, and I don't know the suffering that your life holds right now, but I do know this: you are not alone. And I know that the good news Jesus had for Peter is the same good news he has for you, that you will come to know a new life through your suffering. Thanks be to God. Amen. Will you pray with me? God of us all, in our suffering, in our pain, in our infallible and inescapable humanity, in our hiding, in our bargaining, in our writhing, you meet us still, and we are grateful. May we rest in the assurance that you accompany us in the pain, transforming our wounds. Amen.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Betsy Lyle Swedenberg, pastor of Northridge Presbyterian Church in Dallas, Texas. For a free transcript of her sermon, "That's What He Said, Get Behind Me, Satan," call us at 404-815-9110. That's 404-815-9110. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. Remember, Day One depends on the financial gifts of faithful listeners like you. Please consider supporting our ministry with a generous donation. We appreciate it. This is Peter Wallace. Next week on Day One, we're pleased to welcome the Reverend Olu Brown, lead pastor of Impact Church in East Point, Georgia, and a church leadership consultant. You won't want to miss his powerful message from God's Word, so join us next time on Day One. Now, our Day One preacher, Betsy Swedenberg, offers some final reflections on her sermon today. That's what he said, "Get behind me, Satan." And one of those scripture verses is in Mark chapter 8. Before we get to that, could you help us more generally, how should we handle such troubling scriptures?
Well, I think that just that instinct. I love that my professor said that. I wasn't expecting him to say that at all, but I thought, oh, goodness. I do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. I just would prefer to guard this image that I have. And I think we do that in a lot of ways. We're a culture that curates things so well. I think having the confidence to be able to open ourselves to texts that are hard and be able to encounter them by asking, what truth is in here for us? Mm-hmm. That both things can be true. There can be hard words. There can be things that we'd prefer not to know about God. And yet, it can still be true that God is gracious, God is compassionate, God cares for us and for this world. So you can't let one overcome the other. But I think that tension is really important to our faith. And that tension is very important to living as faithful people in today's world. Mm. We're not granted a world free of tension. So I think the more we can practice encountering hard scriptures, hard truths too sometimes, it better prepares us to live as faithful people in this world.
Mm-hmm. And here we have Jesus rebuking Peter, who just correctly pronounced Jesus the Messiah, and he says, "Get behind me, Satan." It's a harsh word indeed, but what brought that rebuke about was Peter's attempt to cover his ears and try to soften or dodge what Jesus had said about the path before him, a path of suffering and death. We all want to avoid pain and suffering, you said, just as Peter did, but Jesus knows that suffering can't be avoided. He's prepared to walk through it because facing pain is part of our sacred journey, you said. Would you say more about why that is so?
There's an attention very early on. You think about parents with an infant. We're trained to comfort or to soothe when things are hard. Mm-hmm. You think about this instinct for parents to want to take care of things for their children. They want their children to be happy and not face hardship. I think that that's natural. Mm-hmm. And I think it shows up in so many ways because it's one of the instincts that just gets nurtured so early on. For all of us, we hope, it's good to know that there are people who care about our comfort and our comfortability. However, that doesn't mean that we get to just go around suffering or pain. Mm-hmm. And I think that it can be really unhealthy if we allow people to think that there is a possibility of experiencing this world without pain. Mm-hmm. You know, in Mark's gospel, in the very first chapter, Jesus is driven out into the wilderness. It takes not very many verses at all for Mark to show us that, oh, yeah, the road is not going to be easy for Jesus. And I think Mark spends a lot of his gospel trying to set us up with hearts that are open enough and expansive enough to encounter pain. Hmm. I think Mark tries to be very honest about it because at the end of the day, he knows that's required for us as followers of Jesus. And so to me, it's refreshing to have someone who's willing to be honest about it. And thinking about this text in light of the pandemic, I had moments early on in the pandemic where there was something that changed because we were experiencing a shared trauma. All of a sudden, people lost the instinct to have it all together because there was a communal suffering. Yeah. And I think there was freedom in that for a lot of people to be able to name their pain, because we go to such great lengths to cover it up. We think about Instagram reels and Facebook posts where we try to show our highlights because we want the world to know we have it all together. But the power for us as people of faith is to be able to claim our whole self and to bring even our broken selves, trusting that that's enough and that we're loved because of that, not in spite of it.
The powerful story you shared about David Bailey reminds us that we can learn much from our painful circumstances if we ask God to guide us through them. Pain can be our teacher, you said. Pain can give us opportunity to learn something new about ourselves and our faith. So how do we open ourselves up to living in that way?
That's a great question. I think it takes practice. I think some of it is just recognizing your posture towards the world. It's a really powerful thing to think about what it is you say to yourself, to think about what it is you say to God when you're praying. That shift, I love that David was able to so clearly name in his prayers, where he went from why me to what now? And all of a sudden, what that did, it was like his glasses on the world changed, that all of a sudden he was able to see what it was God was doing in his life. Another friend and mentor of mine, Tom Toole, told me that for a while he was saying a prayer and he was saying, God, I need something from you. Give me something new. And one day he looked down and he realized that his hands were clenched into fists. And he realized, well, God couldn't even give me something new if God was trying, because my hands are closed to it. And so he said that just the simple act of praying with his hands open and his palms facing up remind him that our posture is really important to how we encounter the world. And I think even shifts as small as that, well, they are small, but they're also big because they're embodying what it is we believe and what we're open to. And so I do believe when we change our question and change some of our body language, it helps us open our hearts to what it is God is doing in this world.
Betsy, what's one thing from your sermon that you hope our listeners will carry with them in the days ahead?
I hope you know that it is so natural to want to avoid the pain, but our faith doesn't give us that luxury or perceived luxury, that the beauty of our faith is that God has done that. God has already suffered, so God can walk alongside us when we are suffering too. And I think in the pandemic, one piece of pain that we all felt was that there was no one who could say, I've done that before. Those are really powerful words when you're experiencing suffering and someone says, you know what, I've been there before, you'll make it through. And we were all deprived of that because we were all experiencing something for the first time. But when you are facing suffering, the beauty of our faith is that we have a God who has experienced that and has promised to walk alongside us through it.
Betsy Swedenberg, thank you for being with us.
It is such a joy to be with you, Peter. Thank you.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.